Welcome to Ordain and Establish, a podcast of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition at Catholic University. To learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.
So we've been studying the virtues, and we ended with the gifts, the fruits, the Beatitudes. And the question now on the table is, how does our knowledge of this, how does the instruction we received in the conversation we've had, how does that shape our day jobs by shaping our persons? That's the overall question. And so we invite questions or follow-up.
So this is a big question, and I'd only expect like a 3-minute drive-by to it. But one thing that I've been kind of puzzling over is that given the strong role of intellect and reason that has really gone through every session, it does strike me there's in the air, I guess, you know, the fancy term would be a kind of non-cognitivism or a kind of humanism that is very skeptical about reason. And I see this with students all the time, right? That, you know, even if they're not full-blown relativists, that they kind of have a view that, well, even morality isn't really about truth or falsity. It's about perspective and the sentiment and emotion and things like that. So from the Thomist perspective, other than say, well, you're wrong, like, where do you know, kind of what's the entry point pedagogically for engaging with that kind of views so that people can kind of get an entry into whatever area while we're talking about it, can kind of an entry point into a view that is more rooted in some of the kind of principles that we've been talking about. Again, sorry, it's a big question. I'm really
sure. Do you mean a sort of emotivism? Yeah. So there are whole theories of moral philosophy where the idea is that if you make what seems to be a moral judgment, you're in effect just expressing personal preference,
yeah,
approval or disapproval. This sometimes has been called the boo hooray.
Yeah, and then also, I mean, I guess, you know, in some ways, maybe unfairly, perhaps critical legal theory would be a kind of local neighborhood, you know, manifestation of it. But just it views that are highly skeptical of the powers of reason and intellect to drive to conclusions in, you know, in practical areas.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, in practical areas specifically?
Well, in law, yeah, or politics or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go. Look, so because C.S. Lewis, and I think it's Abolition of Man, right? So you invite me over to dinner, and I just don't show up. And then you say to me the next time you see me, what happened? You had invited me over to dinner, you didn't show up. And I say, yeah, so what? Right? No one responds that way, right? But what actually happens is I say, oh, I forgot, right? Which is sounds like an excuse, except it's no excuse at all. And now I have to take you and Anna out to dinner at someplace really nice at my expense. Okay? When I say to you, so what? You know the legal equivalent of that is? I move to dismiss. All right? The basic structure of our moral reasoning in everyday life, which these people admit and use all the time, exactly carries over into law. Right? And if I move to dismiss and my excuse I forgot is no excuse at all, I admit liability and I compensate you by taking you out to dinner. I don't think anybody, very few people, are really thoroughgoing emotivists like Stevenson or H. A. Eyre. They don't behave that way in their everyday life. They're giving reasons all the time for what they do and don't do.
Well, isn't the real challenge here Oliver Wendell Holmes? So the bad man and the idea that moral theory doesn't belong in law at all, that it's all prediction and we have to calculate the law based upon the worst incentives. And so you sort of stop thinking about the best incentives or the better motivations. And I feel like that's the challenge. Like that's how I, when I think about the problem in the classroom or in scholarship, I think that's more what it is.
But I think there's another kind of version, it's iteration of the Powell and.
Yeah, I think the other thing though is that what we learned through this week is a role of the passions. Mm-hmm. It's a saint, or I guess he's saint, is he? Blessed Robert Southwell. Passions I allow, loves I approve, only I would wish that men would alter their object and better their intent. So, or Augustine, the entirety of the Christian life is nothing but the cultivation of holy desire. So they're not far off in that the appetitive, that's true. They're just not incorporating it into, and the other thing we were talking about earlier, their sense of reasoning is an exsanguinated sort of positivist Hans Kelsen sort of reasoning that doesn't have, that's primarily discursive.
And Mark, I know you want to, I agree with that. I always say that if I were talking to someone like that, I would point to the fact that even the emotions have order. You desire this and not that. So that's what reason's actually looking at. That's why I kept talking about the eternal law. It's the underlying order in everything. God
didn't blame
that. Exactly, yeah. Emotions, like I like sweet, delicious things, not in hunks of dirt and rusty nails. Why? So even the emotive life is not a step away from order, even if it is an underappreciation of the rational appreciation of order. So there's no such thing as unordered existence. Like you couldn't have that form of life. That's unintelligible, it's impossible. It's a bark blazer.
Actually, after the two of you have spoken, it's just a footnote to what you said, because I was struck in these sessions by how much time we spent on the emotions, and also a little bit an answer, Father, to your answer to Brian's question about what weizen means. It was an extremely capacious kind of understanding, and I thought to myself, well, because I had the same experience as Michael, that you know, the sort of talk of reason is it at best obscure and at worst just sort of rejected. But it seems to me, this has seemed to me throughout this session, that there's been so much time spent on not only emotion, but the first part, habit. Habit, I think, is doesn't normally get associated or custom or, you know, it's kind of with reason. And yet there is a kind of relationship, an important relationship between these things in St. Thomas that I think for most students is sort of alien, right? That isn't the normal way in which they think of what custom or tradition or is all about, right? That's sort of the unthinking side of life. And so these sessions have in some ways reinforced the sense that, no, there's this kind of view of this philosophy, there is this important relationship and sort of two-way street and one influencing the other and so on. So that's been actually pretty helpful for me on a variety of fronts.
Yeah, I think that robust sense of reason, you know, I think of reason as book five of Euclid, ratio, right? It's relationship and fittingliness to the situation, not Spock. And I think that's what they think when they think reason, is they think Spock. And that, for Aquinas, would not be reason. Mm-hmm. It would be more, it would have more aligned with poetry than it would with, you know, Gödel or Bertrand Russell. You know, the fittingliness is more seen in Shakespeare's sonnets than it is in Bertrand Russell's logic. And that's what I think that, It's a kind of appropriateness. it's what's appropriate is what Aquinas is talking about in terms of reasonableness.
I wanted to ask this question with the time rule we finally cut it, and it now kind of directly well into this. I would say that in Aquinas, practical reasoning is always of one of two forms. Either the end is given and I'm deliberating the means to the end, or it's the other way around. I'm trying to figure out what's the appropriate end, like for me as a human being, right? So that's, it's either ends means or means ends. That's it. You agree?
Yeah, I think in terms of, yeah. So, because insofar as both of those types of discursion, reflection would require or are oriented around some type of activity at work. Yeah, yeah.
I'm dealing with you. When Tom says fitting, I mean, I think of that as the means is well calculated to achieve the end, or the activity is well suited to me because of the kind of thing I am, all right? Just like, you know, airplanes are well fitted for traveling through the air but not underwater, and vice versa for submarines, all right? It's always ends to means or means to ends.
That's where I think the fittingness is.
But the fittingness to the final end is something you can't reduce to a calculation. And so to the extent we're closer to virtue, we're not able to express it in a... That's how Bright Russinger criticizes fittest and the new natural law is this is, he thinks it doesn't, that doesn't work because you, well, God's reason is reason. It's not accessible to you in any discursive form. So you're not going to be able to fix it in a, you know, a rule. And that's, I think that's appealing because it's true. I think that's appealing to students because they know that from life, the aoristos is how you have to make practical judgments about stuff, that you can't fix a rule in advance.
And Robert's way of putting it with the means and ends and then the two things reminded me of a text I wanted to ask about, which was, it comes up in the Treatise on Justice when the question is judgment, and here they're talking about judicial judgment, is it an act of justice? And one of the objections is, well, no, it's an act of prudence, there's different things. And Aquinas' answer is, it is an act of justice, but also of prudence, right? So we looked at, it was question 58, Article 4, which is whether there can be moral without intellectual virtue. And the statement, in order that a choice be good, two things are required. First, that there be a due end, the intention be directed to a due end, and this is done by moral virtue, which inclines the appetitive faculty to the good that is in accord with reason, which is a due end. Second, that man take rightly those things which have reference to the end, and this he cannot do. So this is in more or less what Robert was saying. And I guess there, one thing that I find difficult in teaching or even in thinking about law or even in conversing with people who are trying to apply the law is to say, what is the contribution, say, of justice, right? So in that first part, that things be directed to a due end as contrasted with prudence about the law. In other words, what is it for, say, a good judgment that's missing from a complete knowledge of the law, right? Which I take, if I'm to go in accordance with that, like the speculative part, the contribution of prudence. So put prudence and the intellect aside. What does justice contribute when the idea is to conform to an order or a rule? Does that make sense? Why is that moral virtue needed?
Because then it's not just an abstract intentional idea, but it's actually because the will is the motive power. You're moving in that order. It's becoming existentialized, realized. That's the difference between planning something and doing it, describing it and living it.
But if you put aside, say, the person to whom something's being rendered, and you just sort of, you abstract from that person, and you get the categorization right, that is, to apply the rules, you have full speculative knowledge that's, to apply the law fully. What are you missing in terms of making a correct judgment? What is a judge missing? Why do they need virtue?
I think what you're missing in this picture is that when a judge is making a decision here, there's no abstract justice that he's looking to. It's what Aristotle would cause to call legal justice. Right, it gets specified in a very complex way, like who owns the mineral rights under the land. In America, it's whoever owns the land. In Europe, it's somebody else, right? And you know, this is right, really important, and who owns that gold, okay? But it's not like there's an abstract justice you could look at that says, no, as a matter of natural law, if you own the surface, you must own the mineral right. It doesn't work that way.
On the means ends discussion and the practical theoretical reason question, and Kevin's citation actually was a nice one, page 89, just a couple lines down from where Kevin read. It reminded me of the distinction I mentioned earlier, the distinction between practical reason and theoretical reason, and the new natural law gloss on that, which
I think here there's some textual support from, you know, in Aquinas himself at the bottom of the I answer that. So page 89, it's a little riff on, it is by the virtue of understanding that we know self-evident principles both in speculative and in practical matters. Consequently, just as right reason in speculative matters, insofar it proceeds from naturally known principles, presupposes the understanding of those principles, so also does prudence, which is the right reason about things to be done. Anyway, the bottom line for me is that, so I take that passage to, you know, theoretical reason begins with certain first principles, about that are more metaphysical in nature, or logical, and practical reason also begins with first principles, but those are, you're reasoning about things to be done. And to get to the bottom line conclusion in practical reason about what's to be done, you need a prior kind of first principle that's also not just a metaphysical statement about the world, but a statement about what's also to be done. Some things as normative or ends oriented. And I think Finnis and George and others say those first principles are the principles of the natural law. And then maybe the second principle, the second sort of piece in the syllogism would be filled in with metaphysical knowledge. But I don't know if that helps to think about sort of the relation, how reason operates in the oral life and its relationship to thinking about metaphysics in the world. But to me, it's helpful in thinking about moral philosophy in this Pantonistic way.
But assume that, to follow up on both of these points, assume that New Jersey law never commands, requires anything that is contrary to or in some way violating the natural law or divine law or any other law, right? But it does specify to the point of saying, yes, it's not enough. There's not abstract justice. This is justice under New Jersey law. And there is a judge who has a speculative matter, has complete knowledge of New Jersey law on the one hand, and then has complete knowledge of the facts, right? And there's a go as, and the right facts as filtered by evidence law, right? So we have law structuring all of these things, but it's all speculative knowledge in the sense of what is the case. Is there any role for justice beyond saying, well, rule in accord with your knowledge of the law and your knowledge of the facts? Someone who is not, what does justice add to that, right? What is that first piece?
So I think Aristotle and St. Thomas make a distinction between those who do the works of a virtue and those who do them from the habit of a virtue. So something like paying for something you've just bought as an act of justice, paying your electric bill. Both the virtuous man, the continent man, the incontinent man, the wicked man can all pay an electric bill. But then they distinguish between, as Aristotle says, saying it's not enough to do a just or temperate act if you don't do them as the just or temperate man do them. So it's not just the object of the act, you know, in the language of action theory, the kind or type or sort of action that could be done by, say, a judge or a lawyer from a variety of moral characters. But what the justice gets at is things like your motive, your knowledge of the moral rightness, not just a sort of calculative correspondence to, say, the positive law. And also St. Thomas says, in his questions on judiciary power, which we had in there, is that there is required upright zeal so as to pass judgment not out of hatred or malice, but from love of justice. So there's a sense of doing the just act or determination out of a knowledge of its rightness, out of a firm and unchanging character that is the virtue of justice, which causes you to really love and affirm and stably be determined in the face of possible corruption or indifference or whatever it might be. And so I don't know. I think it's like maybe a wicked judge and a just judge could both arrive at the same conclusion, but the moral agency out of which they would act would be relevantly different. And probably in the long term, the fail rate and success rate of them as doing acts of justice would be very different statistically. You know, the just judge might get, you know, 95 out of 100 things right, and the unjust judge be tempted, distracted, or at least indifferent to what.
Yes, I think Kevin has a slightly different question. I think maybe I'm wrong, but the way I understood your question was that we're imagining a judge who has full knowledge of the law, full knowledge of the facts, and it turns out that while that knowledge would settle a whole bunch of cases, it doesn't settle the case in front of him. And then he has to, so imagine that some weird fact situation occurs that never came up before. For the benefit of the theologians, there's this wonderful case about the ship Peerless. There's a contract to buy and sell wool on the ship Peerless. And then it turns out that the Peerless was not Peerless after all. There were two ships called HMS Peerless, which both sailed from India at approximately the same day. And one guy thought it was this ship, and the other guy thought it was that ship. And is their contract a good contract or not? All right. So imagine this never happens before. And the judge has to figure out what kind of rule are we going to use in those situations. There, I think the judge should ask himself, given all our other just laws, given everything else that's in place, given how our merchant system works, what's the better rule in the sense of which rule better promotes the common good here? And a just judge would have better judgment on that question than an unjust judge, because he would understand the common good. But it's very complicated. You have to imagine all the other parts of the system are in place. He can't go rewriting the whole system. He just has to say, assuming it's like this that I've inherited it, that I'm not empowered to change, here are the statutes, here are the precedents, the common law, which seem right. What do I do when this new weird thing happens? What kind of rule are we going to use in those cases?
But there could all, we didn't do the treatise on law, of course, but I mean, there would be some domains in which you could have determinatio of
those kinds of laws in place already.
And consistent with justice anyway, right?
But I think the other point you made, Dr. Elliott, that Aquinas' emphasis is how you make the judgment is very important, not just the result. And we're so focused on what the black letter result is. So my example would be not something like intellectually difficult, but repugnant in some way. So I sat in eviction. So evicting a single mother of four children in the middle of February in Chicago. There's enormous emotional appeal that if you don't address it, if you just, and this is Noonan's critique, if you invent, as he says, the invisible friend, the law, well, the law requires me to evict you. He says that's a bad judgment. That's not in conformity with judgment, with justice, because it's you that's doing it. The truth is, I am evicting you. The law isn't doing it. I am doing this. And unless I realize that that decision won't have the right impact on me, it won't perfect me. It's that realization of that I am doing this is crucial to the perfecting nature of moral action.
He says you can't evict, but if it's otherwise a good eviction, you can't evict her in February?
Well, the solution would be to stay the judgment, you know, until end of May, perhaps. You have to follow the law, but you have discretion to stay it to when it's warm.
Since you're doing this, are you going to pay the landlord the 3 months' rent you've been in this?
Well, it's a question.
Where's whether they're supposed to take that?
That, of course, is...
You are staying it after me.
I am staying it.
Wow. So that's... I'm not sure in that guy's corner. It's not how my world works, I gotta tell you.
Well, I think that's the question, is that a just result? Then you could say, is it, if you infuse it with a little humanness, if you consider the whole human situation, and that's where Noonan is a critiquing of abstraction as a way of legal reasoning. He thinks it's deficient morally to abstract from a human situation. You might do the same thing, but it has to be fitting for all the particulars. You can't remove particulars as if not wanting to look at them because they're painful or they hurt you and they make
but
it repugnant.
Irrelevant.
Well, that's what he says is that. That is, sometimes words allow us not to think, right? So we just by categorizing something as irrelevant, we subtle it off. And he's
saying, emotions cause us not to think too.
Right, but that's where the passional, that's where our reasoning is broader kind of reasoning. Our reasoning, Thomistic reasoning, is more human. I think is the case. It isn't the Bertrand Russell kind of reasoning, and that's its selling point. It's more attractive.
Well, does that make the AI judge inherently unjust then, even if it is
just
scenario, that it's completely determined and you could just apply it, but because it has no ability to have that proper just intention?
Justice requires relationality, which requires personhood. Yeah.
What? You'd agree with that?
Yeah. You couldn't describe the sort of chat GPT conclusion on a case as an act of justice, even if, you know, it was the right decision had a human come to it, because it's just not an act of a mind.
Good. No, but this may be a far field, but the gifts of the Holy Spirit too, do they figure in it at all into thinking about kind of judging? I mean, I see your client talks about counsel and wisdom, or is that purely kind of oriented to God?
No, it could be about this. No, to yeah, David, I already did my piece about it.
No, that's a great question. So Father Cuddy already talked about the gifts, but one thing I just always had in mind is how St. Thomas reiterates that the basic job of the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit are to render a man docile to the motion or inspiration of the Holy Ghost, when God's grace actually moves us either to refrain from some evil act or to do some particular good act. And so you've got each of these seven gifts are affiliated or aligned with certain of the seven virtues, three theological, four cardinal. So something like the gift of fear is associated with the theological virtue of hope and so forth. And so they actually create a certain support network for the theological virtues. But I think it's really interesting if you look at biblical cases like the judgments of people like Daniel or Solomon with the two mothers claiming the baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are palpable and throughout church history, you know, what we mentioned on the break, things like St. Athanasius on the Nile, St. Joan of Arc before her inquisitors, Christ in front of the Pharisees being asked these questions where it seems like each question will get you condemned and he finds a kind of tertium quid. So I think those are instances where you really see the gift of counsel, for example, and the gifts of the Holy Spirit.
You might even say the answer was inspired.
Yes, right, exactly. So not inspired like scripture is inspired, but nevertheless, God, you know, a true motion of the Holy Spirit prompting you towards the right action.
If it's by grace, you can't presume that it'll be there, right?
Is that you can pray for it, but you can't elect it.
But because it's so, I love the example of Solomon with the two mothers and the baby. That's a beautiful, because that is kind of proximate to your domain. That is clearly a modally, that's a supernatural thing. But it was a context. This is very much a question: what do we do in this situation? But yes, we can't presume upon it. But these are habits. The gifts are given by God. This is not a subtle or indirect disagreement with Professor Elliott. Absolutely. I just emphasize in agreement with Professor Elliott that these are habits and that God won't leave us high and dry, those who are faithful to. Yeah.
You see that in the Gospels, when you are dragged before court and y'all think ahead of time,
yes,
what you shall say for the Holy Spirit, you know, so that there is clearly a sense in which there is a role for inspiration. And I think, you know, in the Thomistic tradition, maybe in Gardier's book, they talk about people who are more advanced in grace and sanctification and the virtues have a kind of, it's almost like, you know, Hildegard of Bingen's phrase, feather on the breath of God. There's a particular kind of heightened docility to the motion of the Holy Spirit that they're just honed to acquiesce in a way that others might be, who say have a lot of venial sin even, might be a little bit tone deaf to by comparison.
How do you, when you're teaching Aquinas on the virtues, it's always in a setting. It might be undergraduates taking a requires course. It might be seminarians in formation. It might be, there can be lots of different setting. Does the body of knowledge that we've been studying, does that belong in a law classroom? And if so, how and why, from the perspective of now yourselves as teachers?
You mean the material we've been working on,
right? Some bits, some truths, even if it doesn't require a site or.
Let's remember that Aquinas says, "In we're teachers of human positive law. That's what we're paid to teach, right?" Aquinas says the human positive law doesn't command all virtues. It's aimed at maintaining a certain minimum level of virtue that most people could be expected to, the great mass of people can be expected to reach, especially preventing vices that would hurt other people. Human positive law isn't supposed to do all of topistic moral theology. It's a much more modest project.
What if your area of law doesn't do any of it and then back actively works against it in Nero's every way?
You in your mind?
Yeah. you're in a tough place. I mean, I think you're supposed to be criticizing the law, which is what you do.
Yeah. But using what tools? I guess that's to your point.
Yeah, and it might be, right? In some ways, I want to fight the assumption that it's sort of like adding to New Jersey law. But the kind of Aquinas-specific things, it might actually be, well, here, because of the truth we are as human beings, here's why we need intellectual virtues. Here's why the acquisition of knowledge, or here's why the exercise of a skill, or here's how it's compatible with being a good lawyer and a bad person, and here's how it's not, right? There may be lots of different, it doesn't have to be competitive with the law, or even occupying the same domain to belong in a law school classroom, right? Or to be shaping our pedagogy. And I'm just trying to think about kind of from your experiences of teaching and seeing then how students are formed in the ways that, well, the goals of that particular pedagogy from what you've observed or what you might infer about what our job is in law school classrooms. That's kind of a more open-ended.
So I think we want to form just lawyers. We want to form virtuous lawyers. And I think so, therefore, convincing them that happiness is an activity of the soul in accordance with virtue is very important for their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking there is this real contrast, which I think Jean Porter has picked up on in her book, that I think in the second paragraph or first page of The Theory of Justice, Rawls says that justice is a virtue of social institutions. So it's a kind of abstract property of institutional forms. And obviously this whole tradition said, no, it's about human persons and their virtues. And then you kind of build up from that. Having said that, though, I think that's to me, the kind of moral virtue theory part of it. But then as Robert says, when we're doing human positive law, as it is, you know, derived from the natural law in perhaps highly imperfect ways, we're also doing something different, right? And we're at least not inconsistent, but not coterminous either.
So one thing that, this is a question for both of you. Aquinas says that in making human positive law, right, we have to have the natural law, but then there's all this determinatio that goes on top of it, right? So one of the areas I teach is securities regulation. If I had to hear all of the United States federal securities laws plus the regulations promulgated thereunder, and not even like, you know, further administrative matters, that would easily go to 12,000 pages, okay? As far as I'm concerned, probably there's only one sentence or two sentences in there that are actually natural law. When one of this Rule 10b-5 says, in essence, don't commit fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. The rest of it is determinatio. When do you have to file something with the SEC? If you file, what has to be in the filing? When are you allowed not to file? It goes on, all right? What kind of reasoning is it that goes from, okay, here's the natural law of securities regulation, don't commit fraud, to building us out to 12,000 pages? I mean, maybe we could get by with 4,000, right? Building us out to this reason. What type of reasoning is it that says, okay, we want to make sure there's no fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. Now we got to go implement that in a complex commercial environment. In other words, what form of reasoning is the term not? I think it has to be some kind of practical form of reasoning. So the question is something like, what set of more detailed rules would, you know, minimize the amount of fraud without destroying the formation of capital? Or is it something like this? It's some type of means ends reasoning, but I'm very unclear on what it is.
I think that's right. And I just add two things. Is one, if it's something like 2,000 pages, but you don't have the time to go through it all, you know, sometimes you have to sign those disclosures. It might be something like 21 pages to get this credit card or whatever, and people just glance at them really quickly. Aquinas addresses a related issue, just the sort of impossibility of dealing with all the facts that purportedly command your attention to make a decision. He addresses this in connection with whether it's always a serious sin to violate a religious rule if you're religious. And he says, men cannot be commanded to do the impossible. So if there's in effect a kind of overload and practical impossibility of checking all the boxes, then it no longer has binding force. Another interesting thing with determinatio is the role of custom. Because sometimes it's not so much I need to create a new determination, but custom has already affected a kind of determination, and then it's a matter of actually becoming more aware or codifying that.
Where's the K on the religious rule? Is that in 2.2?
Yeah, I'd have to look that up. I can track that down on the break.
And the last one, could you track that down too? I think I know where that is, but I would love.
Yeah. It's in the questions on natural law and elsewhere, because he thinks some custom has the force of law,
right?
Because it's basically a promulgation by a whole community through action. So it's sort of like performative legislation. So custom can have the force of law. And so one of the questions he asks is whether you should always overturn a custom if you come up with a better law, which is a big deal in his day because of the recovery of Roman law, which was slowly making inroads against a lot of sort of more feudal, customary, you know, think trial by ordeal kind of stuff that had taken place in an earlier part of medieval Europe. So there was always a question of, do you basically upset the morals of, and customs on the ground because you've come up with something better from Cicero or Ulpian that we didn't maybe have access to 200 years ago. And interestingly, he says, you probably know this, he says, all things being equal, you shouldn't, even if it would be a change for the better, because the mere upsetting of people's accustomed habits as determined by the law they know through custom is itself prejudicial to the force of the law and makes them start to call into question the bindingness of the law itself. But anyway, yeah, happy to look at the custom.
And just the reason why all that, those are fascinating questions, is because people usually act, particularly in social settings, reasonably. So there already is an order of reason present here. It's like removing from complete chaos. It's not like the Lord of the Flies to, like, you know, New York City or something. We can call that, you know, similar, but, you know, something.
That is Lord of the Flies.
Biggie! This will no doubt flip you out for Father Cuddy, but I have a whole lecture of law and economics, which is aimed at showing that people are rational almost all the time.
There we go. Okay.
All right. Good. You usually end up dead if you're spectacularly irrational. Anyway. One of the ways that this comes up in my field is in first-year criminal law, where I start by having them encounter a little bit of punishment theory, but then we quickly move to kind of the progression of mens rea standards from a common law basis. And then inevitably by like class 10, I have students who are just so frustrated with jurists from the 1800s trying to think through the mental states of individuals who have committed crimes to distinguish their culpability. So they thirst, they yearn, right, for some sort of predetermined set of mens rea standards. And
voila, here come tons of smart people in the 1960s who create the model penal code, right? And this is supposed to be kind of like this saving moment for them, and it will reduce their anxiety as they try to learn criminal law. And then, you know, by class 20, they realize, well, wait a second, these standards aren't actually any better than the ones that the people were reasoning about through moral philosophy for like 1,000 years, if not longer. But to your question, Kevin, like, does this belong in my 1L criminal law classroom? I don't think I could then stop and detour to moral theology, right? But I've had students come up to me. I actually had a student who was in the first year I was teaching and asked me point blank, is there a virtue ethics theory relating to the criminal law? So, there actually is. I would talk to you about this outside class, right? Because for Robert's reasons, I've been tasked with teaching common law larceny because there will be 6 questions on the bar about it in 4 years after they graduate. So you just don't have the time. So I think the answer is kind of, yes, it belongs at a law school. At least I've resolved it. Yes, it belongs at a law school. But precisely when and how that appears is a matter of prudential judgment. And for me, that's kind of come through some indirect direction in the classroom, right? Like, okay, so you would be able to speak about this, Judge, but so we're dissatisfied with the mens rea standards, both at common law and under the model penal code, to determine culpability adequately because of all the particulars. It's not possible for the jury to grasp them all or for the judge to grasp them all. But that's not the only moment where they might be considered, right? They might be considered at sentencing, but that determines on that, that hinges on how we've determined the sentencing regime, right? And I think that's kind of like an indirect way to get the students thinking about some of the questions we're talking about here. But then one more level to that would be, no matter how we determine it, it's not going to adequately resolve
right.
the set of justice-oriented questions, the social questions, the relational questions that you're also yearning for answers about. And that's where, like, the virtues come in, right? And there, I think it's more of a challenge to figure out how to get that into either a law school curriculum, or perhaps the way it comes is through our modeling the virtues, right? It's law professors engaging in this endeavor in the first place. It's not a great answer to the question, but it's kind of how I've tried to resolve it prudentially over 6 or 7 years.
So I know, Kevin, you've asked, and this has inspired me to think. So we're very, Dr. Ellie and I are, because we're Thomists, we try to think clearly. We're reticent to offer diagnosis or prognosis about your field. But one thing that would be interesting, this is just in light of what you just said, even if one certainly not moral theology, but maybe not even ethical philosophy, one could not be expected to do within a legal classroom setting. But perhaps something like as a segue, an intrinsic openness to those things, even if it can't be covered in the classroom, would be the inherent, not bad, but inherent limitations of legal theory. That our discipline, what we're doing, presupposes some things which we can't get into. And also there's things that come after. In other words, this discipline is a real discipline and an important discipline, but it's a dependent, consequent, and foundational discipline for other things. So in other words, the law comes after and before and above and under other things.
Yeah. In my jurisprudence class, I have them read snippets of the Treatise on Law.
Okay.
I say to them, this is written by someone who's way smarter than I am, right? But it's not the full summa. This is just a small part. So to think that this is going to answer it all is a mistake. And you're going to see later people say that their Treatise on Law does answer it all. And keep this in mind when it gets to that point, kind of a variation of your bearing.
But I'm curious whether, I mean, that's sort of, I think, the way most of us, this indirect and, you know, yeah. Method or responsive method to particular students who are, you know, hungry for this sort of thing. But would you say that we have any duty to, I mean, students don't even know what they don't know, right? And they have no, we've spent much of the last 2 days just defining terms and trying to understand things. Do we have some duty to give them the kind of basic, you know, to equip them to even think about having that, you know, exploring that later? Would you say that should be part of a law school curriculum?
Dr. Elliott, I would defer that to you.
Just say the last bit again.
Well, I mean, do we have some duty as forming lawyers, right, to introduce them at least to the terms or to the notion that justice means something more than just complying with New Jersey law or whatever, you know? Do we have some duty to give them the basic formation, even if that's not what our whole curriculum is about?
Yeah. I mean, even ancient lawyers, you think of someone like Cicero, they saw it as integrated with an overall vision of philosophy and the good life. So I don't think it just needs to be narrowly positivistic or procedural. You can see the law as in service to the common good. And I think the danger of not seeing it is somehow related to, you know, Hopkins has that good line, you mentioned it last night, the just man justices. If there's no sense of justice as a virtue and therefore of all the virtues, because they stand or fall together, then I think the danger is it can lead to a kind of burnt out cynicism in addition to possible corruption. Just why do this at all? And then you get into the kind of McIntyrean questions, like, why should society regard this as anything other than an act of power? You know, or how should ordinary citizens see the work of lawyers as actually something that is good and not just merely something that controls their lives?
I think some of the problem is that because of the fragmentation of the university, because the challenge is that, fully on board with the idea that every ciencia, every human discipline opens into theological questions of all to their seat. But that doesn't mean that Robert teaching securities regulation needs to be bringing those questions every day, right? But if in the well-ordered university where the disciplines weren't fragmented and pulled apart in various ways, then you could say, well, you know, we're going to do this here. So we don't say everything all at once. I think part of the issue that Elizabeth is pointing to, though, is that, you know, we live in a fragmented university world in which, you know, there's a yearning to do formation and, you know, help students in various ways to holiness eventually. But it's also the case that, you know, we have to teach securities law.
Well, yeah. So what about, though, I think about torts. So the duty, when you're saying, is there a duty, right? And it's to act as a reasonable person would, as a prudent person would. So let's take one more and say, okay, this is as a prudent person would, and it's, you know, relative to a particular society, and there's certain things that don't count, certain disabilities that do and don't count for whatever. Then I think, okay, in reality, it turns out that because Aquinas' mind was so well organized, because he needed to synthesize all these different things, I'm actually going to teach the parts of prudence or something like that. Like, have you found that that actually is useful? Or in terms of do you disguise when the goal is just to use the best knowledge, the best explanation of reality for pedagogical ends, whether it's the law or not? Are there things from the Treatise on the Virtues that you as teachers make use of? How about that as a sort of, you know, in how you do things rather than the what, right? So, but okay, yeah.
Sometimes I think, especially with younger students, so I don't know, because you teach graduate students, but especially with undergrads, it helps not so much to read as much as we have of the Summa as to use a really good secondary work. So I use with my undergrads William Madison's Introducing Moral Theology. And I think it's a really great sort of getting your feet wet in talking about all seven virtues in conjunction with happiness. in a way that ordinary people haven't necessarily studied moral theory. And maybe they're slightly aloof, diffident, not that interested. There's no immediate buy-in. But he's very good at sort of, you know, like when you're trying to coax a bird to eat out of your hand, just to get people interested in them in this by showing how it's relevant to their life, how you can escape moral decision making and so forth, how it's related to happiness and everybody wants to be happy. So I often find for people coming into it cold, who kind of need to cover a lot fast, a work like that, and there's probably others. Our colleague Matthew Meinert has a nice book on moral theology as well at the introductory level. I think that works well with both. I use it for undergrads and even grad students who are just coming to virtue theory cold, because I think it does a lot of hand-holding in a good sense, and is able to take, you know, this is an immense amount of material, but say, boil down a little bit, like take 300 pages and then turn it into 15. So at least people get a general lay of the land, and then you can get deeper into things from there. But what do you think, Father Cuddy? Is
that? I'm glad you're much more into the normal life, Dorothy Diversity. At the DHS, what I do is just on textual level, when I'm teaching systematics or morals, they read it all of the Summa. However, that's part two, there's three. My lead up, they all come, young Dominican student brothers, other religious to study with us, and even lay people. They think, basically, I'm a conservative, I'm an Orthodox, I'm an excited Catholic, and I want to be with Aquinas. And they come, and I view the first third of my job is to dramatically stated, kill that. Because we're not here for rah, rah, rah for a guy that dressed like this who lived in the 13th century. We're here to understand reality in itself. That's the philosophical, and then all things in relation to God, God himself, that's the supernatural, that's the theological. And that's necessary for why we're studying it, because the 13th century and Aquinas are gone, but reality and the God who causes reality is still here. So my first job, ironically, is to say, do not be satisfied, and I will fail you. If you just at the end of this course say, well, this is what Aquinas says, therefore, that's not what we're about. Then I do make them read. We read all the prima pars, all the prima secundae, and the secunda secundae when I used to teach that. That's harder because that's a lot. And we go through it, and I want them to see the arguments, I want them to see the order, but then the last third, and this is where I think Kevin is most proximate. Well, as I go along, I look at what Aquinas says, what we're trying to take out, identify rather, what is the truth, the objective, the perennial, the not just 13th century, but all times, truth content here. And then I try to draw out the practical implications. If this is true, how would this affect a marriage here? If this is true, how would this affect how you celebrate the sacraments there? If this is true, how would you make a determination here? And though invariably, even amongst the very devout and sincere, even the Dominicans, a lot of them say, come out and be like, I didn't realize I was a nominalist. I didn't realize I was a Kantian. Mm. And the most honest say, I still can't.
In confession.
You know, and they still say, I can't. Basically, I've had students very touched. They say, I find reality. I don't trust reality. Like, I don't think this is actually, we've been conditioned to not think you can know reality. We're much more eager to enter into a project of, let's climb into Aquinas' mind powers. Because for all of our education, this is this guy's thought, that it's practical relativism. The historical approach, what does this guy think, that guy think, that guy, that woman. That. But so what you're saying is, no, let's look at reality. So that's scary. And as I told some of you, I'll end with this, I don't want to dominate, but I think the challenge with young students come to us against a little different than other institutions is that there's a certain skepticism which characterizes the modern period in the young people. So when they were growing up, and the world was saying money, sex, and power will make you happy. At some point in their life, they said, I don't know about that. I'm going to think, figure this out for myself. So that skeptical distance from the claims of other people is actually the reason why they come into the Dominican House of Studies and say, oh, we want to study here, because they didn't get pulled into that matrix. But then when they come here and we're saying, look, there's reality, the principle of non-contradiction, being is really distinct from non-being, God is real, he is knowable.
Then they look at us, and that was, okay, I'm not sure about that. I have to figure that out for myself. So what's fascinating is that the thing that preserved them from the complications of modernity, personally, also is a pedagogical impediment that I observe that has to be overcome for, no. Being, you can't escape it. It's not like you don't flip a switch and have being. You're in it. So those are the challenges I face in those three steps at my own very peculiar institution of study. Yeah.
Going back to what Michael said, I think it's really important to realize that different law courses are going to be really different here. For any area of law, you should consider the ratio of natural law to natural law plus determinatio. And in criminal law, that ratio is high. And in family law, it's high. And in torts, it's high. And in securities regulation, it's approaching zero, right? And in mergers and acquisitions, it's don't steal, don't buy, and the rest is determinatio. Right, it really matters what court, and in jurisprudence, it would flip to almost, you know, the ratio becomes almost one.
Yeah, because there's a tendency sometimes, I think, in these conversations, which I've been part of for a long time, to think that, you know, law is related to moral and political theory, kind of like Italian is related to Latin, right? It's sort of a sort of a historical kind of follow-on, but you have to, and obviously, as much of the apparatus you've given us is to think in terms of, well, it's more complicated than that, right? It's not just that, you know, we're kind of refracted moral and political philosophers who are in the law school classroom.
Well, I thought, and what you were saying, Brian, was good. The those two comparisons of the common law and the code, which is more fitting for humans, which is a more fitting way of thinking. So Anthony Trollope and Orley Farm, anybody read that book? He has this critique of the code method coming into England as being not, it doesn't have the aristus, doesn't try to like get down to the particulars in the Rio.
Well, I also just want them to think about from a determinatio perspective, which is more in accordance with being human than being rational, but right? Like just, you were complaining about the judge who you thought was just kind of in a back room contemplating, but it turns out that that judge's opinion may have been a better act of his, a more expressive act of his human rationality,
yes,
than committee-based model penal codes, right. Yes. Produced objects, yeah, that probably had some degree of arbitrariness to them,
right?
Right, and they maybe were less in tune with the particulars because they were thinking about this in an abstract, hypothetical,
right, yeah,
sense. And I completely agree with what you just said, Robert, about the degree, and I think that fits with what we've talked about today, right? Or this week, the ordering. It's contingent.
Well, for our order, we need a common action of coming to an end. But Mark, there was something that you...
Just that'd be a very quick ending. And just on
something that Father Cuddy said, which related to something that Sean said earlier. That Father Cuddy said, you sort of want to beat out of them that, sort of Aquinas is it because it's Aquinas. I feel like law students come in and they feel that way about Supreme Court justices. Then, you know, whatever they say, that's true and that's good. And it's sort of a combination of, those are the people who are in power and those are the people that make the decision. So it must be true. And I'm here to sort of drink that in. And I want to beat that out of them also. I want to just because Holmes says what he said, and that's the sweep. Sort of water that we swim in doesn't have to be that way, right? But there's a natural tendency, what somebody once called the ordinary religion of the law school classroom, to feel that it's that way, that it must be that way.
Thank you for listening to Ordain and Establish. Subscribe to our podcast, and if you'd like to learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.